Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hi, folks. It's me again. We have a treat for you. At the recent annual meeting of SBGAN in Milan, the opportunity became available to conduct podcast interviews with some of the real prominences among our group. And one of them is, of course, Professor Benita Kamat. Benita and I go back, although intermittently, for quite a long way. I've watched as she hasn't so much climbed the ladder as she's flown up it, starting at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, moving up to Sick Kids in Toronto, and now newly installed as the chief of the Pediatric Hepatology, Gastroenterology, Nutrition, and you name it division at CHOP. Her particular specialty is Alagille syndrome. And what makes it Alagille syndrome? Not just that, but also what to do about it, how to help kids with it. She's speaking on that, or rather she has spoken on that, in Milan very recently. And again, for those of you who can't be there, and for those of you who were there, were overwhelmed by the detail, and want to get another view of what actually was going on, what the crux of her presentation was, she's our guest today. Hey, Benita, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you, and thank you so much for having me. And if I may start with a small anecdote, Professor Nicely, I remember when I was yay big, running around the halls of Mountbatten Ward at King's College Hospital as an SHO. In a meeting once, you reminded me that Alagille syndrome is arteriohepatic dysplasia. So to always remember that there's a vascular component that was recognized right from the beginning.
I am covered with rue. I should never have ventured to to reprimand you. I'm so sorry.
No. It wasn't a reprimand. It was a very important reminder, and it's one that I've carried with me.
Well, as we move toward arteriohepatic dysplasia, wasn't it your contribution that started to deal with the vascular malformations outside the pulmonary circulation?
Yes, I was fortunate to work with Ian Krantz at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Ian happens to be married to Nancy Spinner, who, as you know, identified both disease genes, Jagged 1 and Notch 2. And Ian was interested, he's a geneticist with multiple interests, and he was interested in the vascular anomalies and Alagille syndrome that are outside the brain. And so we reviewed the CHOP cohort of patients, which was about 300 patients at the time. I reviewed the records and found that 9% of patients had either a structural anomaly or it had an unexplained bleeding event. And we made a figure for that paper. It's in circulation. It's a long time ago now, but really looked at the reported cases in the literature of vascular anomalies and then those from our cohort. And you can see that these anomalies are everywhere. And it's way beyond the internal carotids, as you pointed out, and the pulmonary arteries. And there were anomalies of the renal arteries, of the aortic, the celiac axis. Of course, we see that a lot now as we do more imaging for live donor liver transplantation. And it's just fascinating. And I think we should almost sometimes rethink the whole condition as a vasculopathy.
I like that thought, although I'm not able here and now to see where that might lead us. So, but that's why you're here.
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, first of all, I have to say one thing. One of my greatest regrets is that I never got to meet Daniel Alagille. I think that is probably one of my biggest regrets in my career. But he has, of course, inspired me. Everyone who knows him have told me that he really cared about the whole patient. And that's why studying Alagille syndrome or making a career out of it is so fascinating, because you go beyond the liver all the time. And of course, the liver is my first and last love. But what's been brilliant with Alagille syndrome is taking these other paths. So to think about vasculature, to think about the heart. And then most recently, I've been thinking a little bit about thyroid involvement in Alagille syndrome.
I was about to ask you about that. Now that I remember that Jianxi Wang was kind enough to show us that in FIC1 deficiency, ATP8B1 disease, that the thyroid was not functioning normally. That could have been expected. It's an epithelial structure, and it secretes. And if its apical membranes are not quite organized, well, no big deal. We see this. But how do we get from Notch 2 JAG1 lesions to thyroid disease?
Well, we recently were invited to collaborate with a brilliant group from Spain and the US together. It's a multidisciplinary group who have a mouse model of, they're looking at thermoregulation and the role of Notch signaling in maintaining thyroid homeostasis in a subset of thyrocytes. So this is novel. This was published just last year in Nature Metabolism. And they've found that link, that a subset of thyrocytes are susceptible or they are controlled, they have Notch signaling that maintains thermoregulation by means of maintaining thyroid homeostasis. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Very detailed paper. But along with that, they asked us to look in the GALA database, which we have, and we were able to identify about 5 out of 20 patients who had thyroid testing performed were hypothyroid. And that links back to the mouse model that when they block Notch signaling and they block JAG1, the mice become hypothyroid.
Okay. Maybe this is a good time for you to tell all of us listening out there about the GALA study and about how to contribute, how to participate in it.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So we started GALA in 2018, and I will actually freely admit it started because an industry partner said to me, Benita, IBAT inhibitors are coming down the road and regulatory agencies and the community will need good natural history data. And I'll be quite honest, up until that point, I had no experience of clinical trials or what regulators need or how you get drugs to market. An industry colleague said this to me, and she said, you need to set up an international effort. And I said, that's fantastic. Why me? She said, because I was fascinated. She said, because
why
you...
not you?
I think she said it was because I'd worked in 3 major countries and she thought that I could perhaps bring people together. And we started in 2018. I thought that if we got to 500 patients, I would be over the moon. And we're currently at 1,700. And it is...
Let me just repeat that. That's 1700, folks.
Yes. But it's really a testimony to the collaborative nature of pediatric hepatologists. That's what it speaks to for me. And I think one thing that was very important to us was also to capture data from smaller sites whose data are not typically represented in the literature.
Yes, ma'am.
So important. So even if you have one patient at your site, we will take your data.
I love it, and it makes the net as fine meshed as possible. There'll be some bycatch, mind you, has to be shoveled off the deck, but you'll have a lovely, lovely, lovely catch all in all.
Right. I believe so, and we're now up to almost 90 centers and 36 countries represented.
Now, this explains to people at home why when you actually look at the articles that will be footnoted in the cover note to this particular podcast, you realize why the title and the list of authors and the list of institutions goes on for 3 pages before you get to the meat. But the meat is very meaty meat.
I think, though, Alex, it's very important to me that authors do get acknowledged for their work. It's very easy for those of us who work in big centers, ivory towers, perhaps. We get a lot of acknowledgement for the work that we do, and it isn't possible. And so if we don't have collaboration, so I wanted every author to be represented and not just be an acknowledgement or a with thanks to, they needed to be listed as a co-author. And so we've sometimes not been able to publish in certain journals who don't allow that. And I would rather pick the journal and keep my co-authors.
Well chosen. So what is the natural history of liver disease in a large international cohort of children with Alagille syndrome?
So when we looked at the children data set, which is an NIH-funded consortium of 14 North American centers that are all liver transplant centers, we found that about 75% of children were transplanted by the age of 18. But clearly there's a referral bias in those data. So when we looked at the GALA data set, which is more representative by country, region, different size centers, we found that approximately 50% of patients were transplanted by the age of 18. So I think that's a more real world view.
But it's not entirely in terms of mutation, in terms of subclinical disease. You're seeing, again, what's over the surface of the water in that much JAG1 or much NOTCH2 variation likely is clinically not manifest.
Absolutely correct.
Or free of liver disease manifestations.
Absolutely. Though those data represent children who present with cholestasis and make it to a liver clinic.
Okay.
That's not the true consequence of having a JAG1 mutation.
No.
In fact, a long time ago, in 2003, we did look at that. We looked at what are the consequences of a JAG1 mutation. What we did is we did a study where we took probands and then excluded them from the analysis and looked at their first-degree relatives, none of whom had come to medical attention on their own. And so therefore, we were able to capture what the milder end of the spectrum, phenotypic spectrum of JAG1 mutations there is. And in that group, the first-degree relatives who had not come to clinical attention, only 30% had liver disease.
So now, but this takes me to something else, which is among your GALA participants, the ones with, quote, more severe disease, the sort of disease is eliminated from a lot of further analyses because the children, frankly, die very young. How many of them are you going back? From how many of them are you taking archived DNA samples and going through a full court sequencing to find out what cofactors are possibly responsible for the less favorable outcome in those children?
Well, of course, you ask a crucial question there, which is the role of genetic modifiers, which at present we don't fully understand, and we're not doing that yet. We have done that in a different exercise, though. We did a genome-wide association study in collaboration with CHOP a few years ago, where we took a cohort of patients, all of whom had a JAG1 mutation, and then we did genome-wide screen on those patients. But we stratified them into severe liver disease and mild liver disease. So really, it's not a gene identification GWAS, it's a gene modifier GWAS. So you're right, trying to look for a genetic modifier. And that there was no clear hit, but there was one variant upstream of thrombospondin 2, which we have now explored a little bit as a genetic modifier, and that's still under investigation. There are some zebrafish data that support the role of thrombospondin 2 as a potential modifier, but it's still under investigation. But I entirely agree with you. What I think the future should be for Alagille syndrome is that we should be able to look at a patient and say, oh, that patient's a JAG1 NOTCH3. They have a vascular phenotype. Or that patient's a JAG1 delta-like 4. They have a cardiac phenotype. That's where we need to get.
Exactly. It's the ones that don't fit into the schema that tell us how the schema must be refined.
Absolutely. Because we go back to our classic criteria as defined by Daniel Alagille, which are so valuable in the clinic phenotypically, but then we also limit our thinking. I think I take the example of NOTCH2, which is something that I brought up in my talk. We've now seen that patients who have an Alagille-like phenotype have less extrahepatic manifestations if they have a NOTCH2 variant. And that's interesting. So they're less likely to have facies. They're less likely to have cardiovascular involvement. I think that's important for the clinician to be aware. You need to rely on genetics. But What I'm not on, the question I've not yet answered is, what's the phenotype of a Notch 2 variant? I've come at it from the allergial phenotype, right? What I would love to do is a more broader study to say, what happens if you have a Notch 2 variant? And we don't know that yet.
But you've gone back to the first degree relatives of those presenting with Notch 2 disease?
We've started to. Uh-huh. It's really important. That's the key question. The key question. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I've distracted you or taken you away from the main line that you wanted to follow about the natural history of liver disease. You say that 75% at major institutions, maybe 50% across the board. Tell us more differences that have been exposed or highlighted by the GALA study.
I think we were also able to identify a biochemical marker so that bilirubin is a predictor of outcome early. So bilirubin between the age of 6 and 12 months can predict your later outcome. And to me, the data that we have in the paper are interesting, mostly because I'm interested in the children we don't need to transplant. That's the group we should try to identify. If I tell you that a child with a bilirubin over 10 milligrams per deciliter is going to get a transplant, that's, you know that already. But what's really interesting is that a child with a bilirubin under 5 milligrams per deciliter has an almost 80% chance of escaping to the age of 18 with their native liver. That's really important. Now, we can think about the pathophysiologic reasons of why that's possible. That's the meat, right? That's really interesting. But for the clinician, they need to know that every cholestatic patient with Alagille syndrome, some of them really do have this possibility of spontaneous stabilization or recovery. Fascinating, completely different to biliary atresia, right?
Yes.
And it's so important. And that's what we need to actually harness in the future in bile duct augmentation strategies, I think, if we're going to find a cure.
In other cholangiopathies, to stabilize the bile ducts that are under attack, to buttress them if they happen to have an inherent weakness, and to perhaps to alter the feed that they get of bile acids by using artificial bile acids or specially conjugated bile acids, as well as by using bile acid intestinal uptake inhibitors.
Absolutely. I believe that IBAT inhibitors, by reducing retention of intrahepatic bile acids, we can create a milieu within the liver, at least especially in Alagille syndrome, where there's potential for either transdifferentiation.
Yes.
Right? And bile duct augmentation strategies.
Yes.
IBAT inhibitors per se will not be curative, but they create a better milieu
they
within the liver.
They will conduce to it.
Yes.
Well, I can't tell you how chuffed I am to be more or less on the same page as somebody like you. It's so real. And I really am sorry about that arteriohepatic dysplasia comment. I was probably having a bad day and needed somebody's head to step on. I'm base that way. We don't know exactly where to slot you in, Benita. Are you a Canuck? Are you a Yank? Are you a Brit? I mean, all of those possibilities. You've covered the waterfront, at least among most of the Anglophone nations. Do you have any tips for people who want, like you, to spread their wings in different venues? What should a young person be getting ready to do in order to make himself or herself a good candidate for transnational work?
Thank you for asking me that question. I was told when I graduated medical school that medicine is a passport to the world. Unfortunately, many countries have thrown up barriers to that, and they've done that mostly in the form of exams. That's what they've done. And those exams are probably the biggest hindrance to how and why people can't move more easily. I think it's a real shame. So my advice to somebody graduating medical school or early on in their career is take the exams for any country that you think you might have an interest in. The biggest barrier is the US. I'm not advocating that everybody should end up in the US, but if you have at least a thought that you might want to spend some part of your training there, you're going to need the exams. So take exams early, because boy, does it get later and harder as you get later on, right?
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
So that's what I would do. Take exams and then open up doors and then go for it. I mean, I'm a Londoner through and through. I love London. I think it's the greatest city in the world. And yet I've spent the last 24 years not living in London and having a whale of a time.
Fantastic. But that, of course, touches on where is the song that you want to recommend to us coming from?
Yes. So the song that I would like to recommend, that's a favorite of mine, is Etta James' At Last. It's a very personal recommendation. I was fortunate in life to have a second chance at a happy marriage, and that's what this song represents to me.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Benita, what a treat to spend time with you. And what a treat to be able to share a little bit of what it is to spend time with you with those folks at home.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.